Good afternoon, and welcome to the afternoon session of the Wednesday LinuxConf.au. My name is Michael Tott, and I have the honor of introducing David Rowe today. I had a chance to meet David over the internet after he kind of announced that he was going to try to make Asterisk work on a Blackfin processor a few years ago. And I wrote him an email, and as best as I recall, that told him he was nuts. It was impossible to deal with shared libraries, the memory requirements, UC Linux, memory fragmentation, and I forget a few other things, including processor count. And David wrote me back and says, well, I'm doing it anyway. I later realized in looking through some source code that about 8 or 9 years previous, he had written some code that had ended up in the Speaks library. And I began to believe that at that point, he learned a few things in that time. It's now been, about 2.5 years since that day. And, well, I'll let David tell the story for himself. David Rowe.
Thanks, Mike.
Hi, everyone.
My name is David Rowe. I'm from Adelaide, South Australia. And for the last few years, I've been working on some embedded asterisks. So a few things I'd like to talk about. The free telephony project, which is how I loosely organize this work. Why you would want to run asterisks on an embedded platform. What my motivations are and some of the other people working on the project. The work I've done is open hardware. And I'd like to talk about open hardware and what that means, especially compared to open software. How you go about hacking open hardware, something that I'm quite excited about, the fact that now pretty much anyone can afford the tools and with the free software to do your own open hardware hacking at home. Some credits, talk about some of the people who have helped with the project along the way. Some of the products we've developed, we've taken this work right through to commercial products, and then a bit of a demo at the end. Okay, so there's a lot of people working in open software, but I guess that one of the big different things we're doing in this project is open hardware. There's four or five of us. We have a background in a professional background, I guess you'd call it, in telephony hardware and software development. I've started, owned and sold companies that develop PCI cards. At one stage, my company was bigger than Digium. and that was in the early days of computer telephony around the turn of this century. on Linux. So there's a bunch of us who are interested in this sort of thing. Basically, we develop the hardware designs and we give them away. Anyone's allowed to copy them, just like open software, to use them for whatever they like. Consequently, there's a bunch of commercial guys who have jumped on the designs and are using some of this technology as sort of the engine for their telephony products, and some people who we've partnered with to manufacture these designs commercially. So, the hardware designs can be copied, modified, and reused without restriction. We use a variety of licenses. One of the issues is we're not quite sure how they stack up legally at this point, but we're throwing the stuff out there anyway, without worrying too much about that. Unlike most other hardware vendors, we actively encourage cloning of our products. We do ask people who clone them, but you know, would they like to help out a little bit? Most of them don't. But we ask anyway, and we tend to stop answering questions if they don't help us. But that's the commercial world for you. There's a trend that I guess I've noticed over my career of functionality shifting from hardware to software. An example with telephone systems is a few years ago, a telephone system was a bunch of analog boards that switched between a telephone and a telephone line to make you call, either internal or external. Now that's suddenly moving across to the software. Now the voice packets are switched in some sort of processor. The good thing about that is software, of course, can be free and should be free. So what we're seeing is that total system costs are dropping constantly because we can now use a piece of software which is free to implement functionality that used to be in hardware. So there's a trend to your bang for buck, if you like, is getting higher and higher. Or another way of looking at it is that the hardware costs are dropping for a given amount of functionality. A good example is a router. You can go and buy a router for $100 now. Cisco was selling those for, 10 years ago, probably 10 or 20 times that. So falling hardware costs I guess I had to think about this, and I think it's generally a good thing. It may not be such a good thing if you're an incumbent with an expensive piece of hardware, but for the average guy like us, and in particular people who don't have a lot of money, like in the developing world, falling hardware costs are a good thing. The model I've got in my head is that hardware costs are dropping towards zero. Can't see? Hat. You want to take my hat off? See my shiny bald head? My pleasure. Okay, so yeah, the model I've got in my head is that hardware costs are driving on zero, like an asymptotically drive towards zero. That happens for a lot of reasons. One, as I said, functionality can shift from hardware to software. One processor can do multiple tasks. The other reason is people compete. If you throw a design out there, people will try and undercut each other. One guy will undercut the other guy by 5%, the other guy will go down another 5%, just through normal commercial practice or greed. They want to make the sale, so they undercut. So I guess what I'm hoping to do by throwing all these hardware designs out there is that people will copy them, compete with each other, and drive hardware costs down, all without me having to do very much or set up my own factory. So rather than protecting the hardware IP, I'm trying to leverage this trend to drive the cost of telephony down by simply giving away the free hardware designs and encouraging their cloning. Consequently, we work very well with the Chinese. They share the same philosophy. And all the things that other people object to hardware manufacturer, we embrace with them. So I had an email about a year ago. I just built the prototype of some of this hardware. And they said, thank you very much, David. You've really helped us. We've used our stuff in some of your products. Is there anything you ever want, let me know. So I said, all right, would you like to build this prototype for me? Thinking, oh, yeah, well, maybe they will or they won't. 3 weeks later, the DHL man knocks on my door. And they fabricated the print circuit board, loaded the parts, worked first time. And so that's the great thing about this game. Just like in open software, when you start sharing things and stop trying to protect your turf, people do nice things for you. And, it's a great feeling. And that company subsequently, based on that, they've gone into production on our products. So it works well for them. They're making money selling them. Works well for me. I have someone else to do my manufacture for me. So why do I call it the Free Telephony Project? Well, the hardware designs are free as in speech. They're not quite zero cost. In fact, the sort of dollars we're talking about are around $400 or $500 for the hardware if you buy it retail today. But I'm hoping to use, as I explained, the concepts of open hardware combined with free software to drive the system costs down as close as possible to zero. And that might mean, doing a lot of channels on a... If you can do 10 channels on a $100 unit, well, you've got $10 per channel, say, as compared to 4 channels on a $500 unit, but constantly trying to push that price down. Hopefully lower the cost of telephony, in particular for those who don't have it. And I guess, one concept I've got in my mind is that a phone call should be a human right, not a privilege. There's no reason why, in terms of the dollars involved, we have the technology today. The amount of money is, for the cost of a small air force, we could get every single person on the planet a phone connection, whether it's wired or wireless. And with this technology, we can deploy a phone line to every hut and every village for maybe $10, $15 in the world. That's all it will cost. So just sort of getting back to the technical side, why embedded Asterisk? Who here uses Asterisk or some sort of voice over IP? Okay, so most of you are familiar with it, I guess. It's a open source telephony switch, switches both between voice over IP networks and analog. But why would you want it embedded? Normally how you build an Asterisk box these days is you get a x86 PC, put a PCI card in it to get your connections to analog phone lines or telephones, and then load some software on it. So the difference with an embedded system, small size, small form factor, sort of size of a DSL router as compared to a PC, very low power. The unit I've got down here operates on 3 watts as compared to 30, 40, 50, even 90 watts for a larger one. I can operate it off this battery. That's a 12 watt hour battery, 12 volts, 1.2 amp hours. This draws about 300 milliamps at 12 volts, so it'll go for about 4 hours on that battery. A little bit more work, we could probably make it run all day. We haven't specifically tried to reduce the power. I'll boot it right now off the battery. No moving parts, fans or discs, it's all flash-based, nothing to go wrong, especially in harsh environments. quiet. Most people in a small office have some problems with PCs in terms of reliability and noise. Low cost, because there's not so many parts, there's the ability to drop the price right down. These sort of things can be manufactured today for the range $100 to $150 each. And it's just plain cool, embedded stuff. Yeah, it has quite a big technical appeal to me. I've always been interested in building a telephony box that combined the DSP and the processing all in one nice little unit. So just a little bit about Asterix for those of you who aren't familiar. It's an open source PABX or PBX. PABX is the Australian term, Private Access Branch Exchange, just means the switchboard in your office. PBX is what they use overseas. I tend to use the term PBX because I've dealt mostly with overseas people in this game. But it can route calls between the regular telephone network, the PSTN, Public Switch Telephone Network, which is your phone line coming from Telstra, and voice over IP. So it's just like a data switch, but it can switch voice traffic between different media types. It's the usual FOSS advantages. VoIP at the moment is undergoing a really massive growth, especially in the business community. If you're getting a new PBX, you're getting one that's got voice over IP, and there's very good reasons out in the industry to go voice over IP. The primary sponsor of Asterix is Digium, a company that's had quite a meteoric growth over the last few years. They're VC funded now, from Alabama in the south of the USA. There's also, because of the popularity of Asterix, it's spawned quite a few alternatives, such as FreeSwitch, CoreWeaver, some of those forks, some of those complete rewrites. So there's a lot of activity going on, mainly in the x86 processor space. So your typical installation for Asterix is an x86 PC, a PCI card that will allow you to switch to connect to telephones or telephone lines. So when you have to connect to a telephone, the hardware's a little bit different. The telephone needs some a DC voltage to make it run, typically around 48 volts, and then you need to give it ring voltage, several hundred volts, peak-to-peak AC signal to make it ring. Horrible analog signaling protocols, if you think about it. You know, the way it detects if it's off hook is the current starts to flow in the line. So, and on top of that, you put analog voice data. Not very changed from about 100 years ago how they used to do it, but seems to work fairly well. When you talk to a telephone line, it's a little bit different. The telephone exchange supplies you with all those voltages, and you just have to do things like detect ringing and take the line off and on hook through the computer. So that's what these PCI cards do. They interface between the PCI bus and the analog telephone system. The embedded stuff is a paradigm shift away from this x86 PCI cards that most people are doing. Some early work in this a few years ago, they did things like they took a WRT54. You can run Asterix on it quite happily, but they don't have a lot of grunt. In particular, they don't have much DSP capability. So they were pretty good at switching IP calls, where you just had to move packets around, much like a router, but not too good. There was no way to connect an analog telephone line to it or a analog telephone, which is where the sort of power lies. If you want to use this thing for a PBX or a switch at home, you might want to take a telephone call off the Telstra line, convert it to a voice over IP call and send it to your laptop or something. So the power in Asterix really lies in interfacing to that legacy analog telephony. And the earlier embedded attempts in this area, while useful, missed out on these sort of core DSP issues. So you need a fair bit of digital signal processing power, DSP, to handle things like echo cancellation and speech compression or codecs. Now the processor, a few years ago I had a real job, where I was developing modem hardware, and I was told to do a review of all the existing DSP processors out there. And I found one called the Blackfin, which was quite a powerful DSP chip that just happened to run UC Linux on it. And a little light went on, because I'd always wanted to build a box like this, and I thought this would be great for an embedded telephony box. So I started working away on this thing part-time, and eventually went full-time on this project, basically using this analog device's Blackfin processor to challenge this sort of paradigm of embedded devices being low power. I found a way to build a high power embedded device that had the CPU and DSP horsepower necessary for real telephony work. So the Blackfin processor is a powerful DSP. It does 1 billion, it runs it up to 500 or 600 megahertz, but for every clock cycle can do two DSP operations. So it does 1 gigamac The way we measure DSP operations is MAC MAC, or multiply accumulate. Multiply two numbers and then add it to the previous result. So it might be just A times B plus C. That one instruction, you can do all the DSP processing that you need to, and a DSP chip is rated in how many of those it can do. Integer, fixed point. So this device can do about a billion of those a second. And it runs UC Linux as a sort of a side effect. Analog devices had ported the toolchain and got a UC Linux distribution running. Normally, when to date, just about every embedded DSP device had two processors, had a host running some form of Linux, plus a DSP chip to handle the heavy lifting that you need for the signal processing. That works, that's okay. I've built many devices like that in the past too, but it's a lot easier if you can have the processing on the one chip. A function call is much easier than a remote procedure call across to another chip, and interfacing between processors on a two processor design is often a source of development issues and bottlenecks. So the Blackfin breaks that two processor paradigm that you do on one chip. It's well supported. Analog devices have about 10 guys beavering away on the UC Linux distribution. Good email response. And the other interesting thing is they were doing some open hardware work. They had the development boards you could buy were all open hardware. So that sort of got me thinking about the open hardware angle. So how do you build an IP PBX? Typically how it works is you have a host PC and a PCI card. They're all the various modules. In this case, the PCI card's got some onboard hardware DSP to handle the DSP work. And it has the FXO and FXS port interface. FXO means it goes to the central office, OFA office, or your telephone exchange. FXS is the acronym for going to a station port. I just remember station port being a telephone inside your office. I just remember FXS, S means station. Now, how we do it on an embedded system is we can integrate some of those blocks together. We don't need DSP hardware, as the processor is a DSP, so we just need some DSP software. And we can integrate the FXO and FXS ports all onto the one board with the main processor. So you get this much more compact design. Many redundant parts removed, and all the advantages of embedded hardware. So just to emphasise the point, there's a lot of, in the asterisk space, you hear a lot about hardware DSP being better than software DSP. Really, there's no such thing. A hardware DSP runs software, it's just on a dedicated processor. And we happen to have one, so we don't need hardware DSP, as the CPU is a DSP. And that has many advantages in the ease of development and cost, of course, less chips. It's not all great. The development environment's pretty complex, just like any embedded system. It's a lot harder than x86 development. I've spent most of my time on this project messing with makefiles, more than I have on the hardware or DSP software development, just to get the bloody thing to build. That's been where probably most of the man hours. So there's quite a big learning curve to get running on that. We've tried to simplify it with some simpler build environments, but it's still pretty hard if you want to, say, add some software to the environment. Not a lot of memory, and UC Linux is very poor with memory management. Asterix also tends to chew through the memory on this system. As it's UC Linux, we don't have an MMU, not a real one anyway. When, say, a processor says we need 1 meg, it will allocate 1 meg of physical memory. Even if it's full of zeros the whole time, it's still being chewed up and not available for other things. So we've had a few problems with not having a memory management unit, and basically that means we have to put more memory on the board than we'd like to, and it's the most expensive component, so that hurts us a bit. There is a partial MMU. It can detect things like writing to zero, that sort of thing, and raise an exception. So we don't tend to get too many crashes due to the lack of MMU. It's more just a poor use of memory compared to what it could be. Also, to get it to run at full speed, in particular for the DSP operations, we need to use every MIP available. We have to be very careful about how we run the instruction and data cache, because that's the only way to reach full speed on the DSP operations. Less important for general purpose asterisk type work, but when you get the DSP like echo cancellation, you need to make sure it's running at full speed. So in terms of the people involved in the project, there's various motivations. A lot of business guys are red hot about the possibility of building a for a couple of $100 doing an IP PBX with multiple analog ports. It has dropped by a large extent the cost. It's got to the point where you can build an IP PBX for less than the cost of an analog PBX, which is a bit of a breakthrough using these sort of designs. So a lot of people in the business world are getting very excited about that. And I've had lots of come and join my VC startup type things and come to me and I say, that's fine, will it be open hardware? And click, beep, beep, beep. You know. So my particular, one other business applications company in Italy we've been working with, it's an enabler for service models. If they can manufacture some version of this for $100 or 100 euros or whatever, they can put it into houses and run a service over it. They're friendly with the open hardware model because it allows them to drive the hardware costs. They want low hardware costs so they can put these in, you know, a million homes in Italy and deploy their service, which they charge for. So the business model, if the value goes out of the business model in the hardware, it can drift to other stages of the value chain for the business types. My motivation is social and geeky rather than business. It used to be a bit of a business. I used to be involved in the telephony business, but now I'm doing more of this for other reasons. I like building stuff. It's a lot of fun. That's the major motivation. I'd like to use my hardware and, in particular, DSP skills to improve the world. There's a lot of people out there doing regular hardware, open software, but not many people doing open hardware or DSP, so I've concentrated in those areas, and I'll let people like you guys, you know, more about software than I do, handle the software side where possible. I think open software has really done some great things for the world. It's certainly done a lot of good things for my world. I'm having a lot more fun with open software than I ever did in the DOS and Windows world. And I'm sort of motivated by guys like Craig Newmark, you know, nerd values, where you get yourself comfortable and then do something fun to change the world a little. So a bit about open hardware. Anyone is allowed to freely copy it, reuse, modify it. And we've got people doing that, companies all over the world, even hackers doing it individually. What we actually distribute is the CAD files. The computer-aided design files that define the circuit diagram and the printed circuit board layout in some cases. They're the sort of things you download, as well as notes on how to assemble and test them. There are a few differences. Atoms cost more than bits. You can't download one of these. You need a factory, or you need to spend a day with a soldering iron to build one. Just like software, huge advantages over the typical closed development, no, you can't look at my product until it's finished and only I'm going to work on it type model. We get many eyes look at the circuits involved, picking bugs, low bug counts, just like open software. Dramatic reduction in R&D cost and time. I've been building hardware products not similar to this for 20 years. I've never ever developed as fast as this before. We're getting fully functional PBXs up 2 or 3 weeks after we get the prototypes back. One of these boards here, I was making phone calls on a week after the solder had cooled on the board. I've never seen that before in hardware development. So dramatic reductions. That means for the business people, that means you get your product to market and start getting profits sooner. For us, it's just great to be doing it a different way and showing people there are other ways of doing things. We use, for the designs, as I said, the CAD files, often text-based, so we use version control systems. For instance, when I was designing these products, I'd do a bit of work on one, I'd check it in. My colleagues in Eastern Europe would jump on it while I was sleeping. They'd add a few more lines to the printed circuit board. I'd wake up, check it out. Oh, great, they've done another 10% of the board for me. And then I'd work during my day. Reusing hardware building blocks. I initially designed some of those FXO/FXS interface circuits that connect to the analog telephone lines. Some other guys designed the actual motherboard, the processor, the flash, got that working. I plugged them together in the CAD software, just like you would software modules, and glued them together. So we're reusing each other's hardware building blocks, just like software. One thing that's a little bit different is helping get strange parts. Some of these parts are a bit hard to find. So I can buy one here at JCAR that they can't get in their local country. So I'll post it to them. So we've had parts crisscrossing the world to help each other build our prototypes. I use a blog instead of a logbook. Typical engineers write everything down in their logbook. I use a blog. I talk about when things break and some of the nice explosions I've had on boards and things like that. And other people, I share that experience and rather than a logbook. And chat to debug hardware. I've had cases where this time last year I was debugging a board and I had a friend in Canada helping me out. It was minus 40 there, plus 40 in Adelaide. And middle of the night there, middle of the day here, and he was giving me tips on how to debug it and we were going back and forth. I've never debugged hardware like that before. It's usually been me sitting at a desk, maybe with some help from a colleague, but using those same software techniques to debug hardware. Some exciting things you can do with open hardware, OLPC type models. So anything you buy, cell phone, router, 70% of it is profit you're paying to someone. Typical ratio is 1 to 3 to 5 times cost of manufacture is the retail price. So something you buy for 500 usually costs around 100 to 150 to make. The rest of it is someone's margin. Open hardware, you don't need to do that. So there's possibilities for dramatic price reductions. That's something I'm hoping to see in particular for the developing world. Is there a way we can build these things and distribute them for cost plus 10% rather than cost times 3 or 4? That's sort of one of the challenges I'm looking at the moment in collaboration with some development organisations from around the world. It's an open design. Someone in a developing country could download the designs, decide to start making them locally. Even the sort of factory you need is fairly modest. Many developing countries would have it already. They don't have to pay some fat Western country profits, valuable currency leaving their country. They can make it locally, have an indigenous industry. Also, you can customise it. All the time, you guys, you know, you're messing with a bit of hardware. Gee, I wish it had this on it. Well, put it on and get it made. You can add those customizations. I'd like to talk a little bit about hacking telephony, hardware and Linux. I use the GEDA, GEDA set of tools. There's a schematic entry, PCB design, and something called Verilog, which I won't talk about here. But this is the sort of design process. The first thing you do is design the schematic using something called GSHEM. These are all open tools, downloadable. You can get a nice ISO you can download. In terms of quality, the schematic tool's pretty good. The PCB tool's okay, it's usable, but it's probably a few years behind where the closed source tools are at the moment for this sort of design work. But very usable, and it's open, and it does have some advantages. So just returning to the design flow, after designing the schematics, generally you design the printed circuit board layout that physically describes where all the wires go. You'll send that away to someone to get made. You'll order all the parts, solder on a prototype, and I'll show you how that's done in a little while. And then you get into testing and debugging the hardware and combining it with the software. In this case, we also had to port Asterisk to the Blackfin processor. This is a screenshot from GSHEM, schematic entry. This is you can see some of the layout to the port connectors there, port 1, 2, 3, and how they're talked to. It's just a CAD tool. You use your mouse to draw a line, and that becomes a net in the schematic. And you can add and remove components, make up your own component libraries, etc. This was the first analog hardware example I developed. So it's three layers. The bottom one is a off-the-shelf development board called a Blackfin stamp. That's the basic processor motherboard. And I designed, using these open tools, the top two layers there, which are what I call a daughter board plus some modules, which define the FXO and FXS interfaces. And that was all designed with open hardware, and I assembled it and got a little bit of help assembling it, as I'll show you in a moment. The point I wanted to make is that hardware hacking really is getting easier. There was a point there that I was a bit scared about doing surface mount stuff at home about 10 years ago. Hard to get the parts, worried about surface mount soldering. Now it's sort of swung back. You can order all sorts of odd parts from web-based online places like DigiKey, digikey.com. They just FedEx them to you in a week or via email. So you can get the parts you need. That was a major problem. That's now solved. Prototype PCB costs are dropping by the day. The first boards I got made, just the bare boards without the parts mounted to it, cost me $500 for minimum order. Then the next time I bought them, they cost me $3 because I made some friends over the net in China. He said, what are you talking about, 500? We can get these for $3. So I said, fine, I'll have 15, and then it cost me $50 to DHL them over here. But things are really getting cheap. And stereo microscope, which is what you need to do the fine pitch surface mount soldering, I paid $700, but then a friend of mine got one for $200 off eBay. So that's coming down too. For less than $500, you can get all the parts you need to assemble one of these yourself. In terms of skill level, if you've soldered at all, then you're about halfway there. A day of messing around with the surface mount stuff under a microscope and you'll be at a level where you can assemble this stuff. It really is not that hard, and I'd like to encourage any of you who want to have a go, feel free to email me or talk to me and I'll help you get started. The other thing is there's free CAD tools now, thanks to open source. There weren't a few years ago. A lot of open hardware designs out there. There's many sites. So there's lots of designs to get started, from very simple to this sort of thing, which is quite challenging. And you get help from online communities. So open hardware hacking is really coming of age. As an example, this is my wife Rosemary, who went through a brief geeky period where I had her soldering. She's never been a technician or anything like that, never soldered a thing. I bought a little kit from Dick Smith's, taught her to hand solder, and then spent a little bit of time, and here she is assembling that previous prototype. And she did a good job. For some reason, females tend to be better at this job. All the best surface mount loaders are females that I've met. I don't know why, it's sexist, but there it is. I can't solder as well as them. I taught her to assemble, and she's got absolutely no experience at all. My kids have had a go, but they're a bit rough. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Something about it. The sort of products that we've built. I guess there's four that are in the pipeline. The first one is the IPO4, four-port analog PBX. I've got that running up front. I won't hold it up because I've got it running. And it won't be if I hold it up. But that's a four-port analog IP PBX. I brought that to life last Easter or so. Went in production by July. We've sold about 500. We can't make enough. And we've now moved on to the IPO8, which is the same thing but 8 ports. It's got dual Ethernet ports and USB, and that'll probably go into very high volume production over the next year or so.
What's the business
Yes, that's right. For home use, you might just use a subset. You might have one FXS port and one FXO port, one analog, one phone line, yeah. Also, a lot of the people buying it now are early adopters messing around. A lot of them are competitors. I get so-and-so company, telephony company in Taiwan, please send me hurry unit. And where can I download schematics? So they'll all bob up this year too, probably. And hopefully drop the price down. I sell them off my website. The four-port one costs US $450 for four ports. They cost about a third of that to make, as far as I know. I don't know the exact production costs. I don't ask too many questions from the Chinese guys. But I'm hoping that'll drop.
The ports
the ports are modular based, and perhaps if you come up later and have a look, but basically you plug a module in depending on which port you want. So if you want four FXS ports, you plug in four FXS modules. The same module design as Digium use. So you can even buy one without modules and plug your Digium modules in.
How does the regulation sort of side work of the device?
Yes. One thing we haven't got yet is compliance testing. In fact, it started. We've got part of that done for the IPO4.
And does that add a fair bit of coin to the...
Once it's done, it's a one-off cost. It costs around 10 grand to get them compliance tested. Compliance testing is where they make sure, one, it doesn't radiate too much interference, so it upsets your wireless and your radios and TVs. Two is they plug it into the telephone line simulator and make sure it does the right thing electrically. They zap it with simulated lightning and try to blow up your pride and joy just to prove that it won't kill you if lightning happens to hit the telephone line, which it does. It's designed to be compliant. I've designed a lot of compliant product, but you only tend to do the tests once the hardware is stable and you've decided this is the thing I'm going to put into high volume manufacture. They cost 10 grand each, the tests, and if you fail it's a lot of messing around. So I think they'll probably be doing the full compliance, like worldwide compliance on the IPO8 over the next few months. You said it. Yep, it's a fraction of the cost, just like everything else over here. Yeah, that's what I found out. After paying 3 grand of my own money, I found that out. 500 there. Other products. Thank you. This is an E1 T1 IP PBX, 32 channels. Been developed by some guys, or international team, but mainly some guys in Canada. Using the Blackfin, once again, that can do... An E1 T1 is a digital line used for high density, and that'll do 32 channels. There's also a BRI, basic radar ISDN, which is quite popular in Europe, used a little bit in Australia, that's also in production. In prototype, we expect all these to be in volume production by the middle of this year, I guess, which is all the major interfaces.
Also,
Sorry, can do.
Fax receiver,
It can be done analog or digital if you have a fax modem inside it. So the IP04 is the first commercial product. I'll run through a demo of that at the moment, but suffice to say, it sort of achieves everything I was hoping to out of this project. We've got something in production. In particular, I wanted to get something out there that software guys could work on. Not everyone wants to solder, but once we get it to this point, it's just like hacking on a WRT. You know, you've got your bootloader, you've got your tool chain, you can do anything you want on it. So that was the main priority for me last year, and we achieved that. We got something out there people can hack on. It's got the potential for very low cost. I'm working with some guys in some development organisations. Three of these units are going into Nigeria later this month to test in a village, environmental issues, thing like that. And the idea is to give some people telephones who currently don't have them. Similar products are selling for up to $2,000 retail. We're selling for about a quarter of that and can be made for 5% of that. At the moment, I've been focusing on hardware, so the product I consider stable, but not feature complete. A few things like the GUI and the caller ID, stuff like that, are a bit unstable. That's the IP04. It's running down here. The big square thing's the Blackfin processor, and you can see the four modules. In this case, two of them are FXS and two are FXO. Also got an SD card. That driver doesn't work very well at the moment either, but everything else, it's extremely stable hardware-wise. Many people just hook them up, left them running. No problems. Yes? Thank you. Got to repeat the question. Are the FXO and FXS cards my own design? I have published the design for them. These, although I can't take any credit, the design comes straight off the application note for the chip that you get from the chip vendor. All I did was re-entered it, and it worked. Firstly, yes, they're pin compatible. They also copy just the reference size, right down to the same numbers on all the circuit. But to their credit, you know, I used all their drivers, and Digium have been a big help in getting all. Well, they haven't helped consciously, but they've been a big help. Sorry, question behind.
What I want to ask is, how long do you think the period before the price will drop to $100?
I don't know. And it may not ever drop to 100. 100 is the manufacture cost. There's got to be a business model where people can make money out of it. Otherwise, why are they going to sell it? So I don't know. That's what I hope to. I just hope to stimulate it. I'm not the sort of guy with the megabucks to push them into volume. It's a bit of an economic experiment. Oops.
How do you how do you develop this
basically? How do you control it, was the question. There's a couple of those headers there connect to RS-232 ports for a console, and you've also got the Ethernet. Right, to it. That's a picture of the primary rate I was showing. Yes?
It will go dark, so you can see it, but we can't see the printer.
Oh, that's all right. You know what I look like. There's one up here. I mean, come on. Touch and feel it. Well, don't touch it too much. You might have static. come and have a look. So that's the primary rate appliance by the ASFIN team. They've got a blog, asfin.org. You can read all about it. And that's got one of those SD cards sitting on it as well. That uses one of the high-end Blackfin 600 megahertz.
And that small board will do 32 channels.
Yes. Wow. Not sure how many more. It will need a co-processor to handle echo cancellation, that one, though, because of the number of channels. But it has been demonstrated running 32 SIP calls.
Yeah.
That would have cost you $20,000 for that PBX a few years ago.
Do you have any idea of costs to the consumer?
This will be €400. Yeah. But we're mixing questions in, or?
I mean, if you've got talking on a pin, you should probably do that and then do questions.
Okay.
You've finished your talking.
I'm one slide away.
Okay, so if you can just pick, we'll do the last.
Last two slides before any more questions, please. Can you dim the lights one more time, Mr. Music? No. Okay. That's the Bri appliance, same box as the Pry. A basic rate is what they use in Europe. It's a digital line, but only two channels per line. Some people use it in Australia too, in New Zealand. That's very similar to that are basically an 8-port PBX. One sort of interesting thing we did was a very free phone call. When I first hand-assembled one of these PBXs. Because it was open, much to my surprise, a bunch of other guys tried to beat me to it. And I designed the bloody thing. I wanted to be the first one to test it, you know what I mean? So these guys in China get it going a few hours after I do. And of course, the natural thing is let's hook up and make a phone call. So we made this phone call between Adelaide and Beijing using an open hardware design that was designed with OpenCAD software, running UC Linux and Asterisk, which are both open source, using VoIP at a $0 call cost. So I was wondering whether that was the freest phone call that's ever been made. Because even Alexander Graham Bell was enmeshed in massive patent wars around the turn of the 19th, 20th century. So we reckon we did something pretty special there. I'm not sure if we have time for a demo. Perhaps I'll throw it open to questions. We can come and have a play if you want.
The removable flash module.
Yes. No. Question was, is the removable flash the SD card the primary storage mechanism? No, it's not. We added that more of a backup. It's got 256 megabytes of NAND flash, and it only uses about 10. That's it. There you can see it's using 8%. 8% of the flash. I've just telnetted into it. It's using 8% of the flash. So it's flash is so cheap because it's in your MP3 players. So we don't really need that removable thing anymore. So no one's really bothered to get the device driver running properly. Yes.
You treat the DSP chip because it is a DSP chip. Is it effectively just working like a CPU as far as the system is concerned, or are you actually still doing DSP things, I suppose?
The question was, is the DSP chip, we treat it like a DSP or as a general purpose CPU? It can sort of do both. It's got a DSP instruction set. We have to give it some, most times it's running like a regular Linux CPU. When we want to do full-on DSP things, we have to take precautions like make sure the DSP code runs in internal memory rather than the external SD RAM to make sure it runs fast enough. And we have to generally code the DSP in assembler to make sure you get the absolute maximum out of the chip. Yes?
Any recommendations on PCB fabrication?
Questions on recommendation on where to get your PCB fabricated? Go to China. There's a bunch of online sites where you just upload your Gerber files, pay X amount, and your thing arrives. Just sort of up the back there, yeah?
Just a general hardware question. Any thoughts on the best way, or have you guys approached getting MAC addresses?
Okay, the question was, what's the best address of getting assigned a MAC address? I don't know. The guys from China just set it up, and I wondered the same question. I should ask them. If you send me an email, I'll ask them. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You mentioned JPEG before.
That's a good idea. No, I haven't. Question was, have I spoken to JCAR or anyone about doing a kit for it? Who'd like to see a kit for these? ATIC approved kit could be tricky, but yeah, we can do a kit. I've actually got some of the harder parts are available for sale off my website. And I was even thinking of running a few sort of workshop sessions, maybe it's something like this, to build them. Yes, okay, I'll put some effort into that. Thanks. Yes?
What kind of RAM footprint?
What sort of RAM footprint? You mean what? Oh, how much does it use? Good question. So there's 64 meg RAM chip and there's 21 meg free for everything at the moment. Asterisk, it's using 13 meg at the moment. Yeah. No special optimization. The question was, what is the RAM footprint? No special optimization has been put into Asterisk. We must do that one day. Yes, Mike. Yes, Mike did this last week. We sat down and had a bit of a session and we got Asterisk 1.6 beta running with 130 modules using 30? Yeah, how much memory was it using?
30 meg.
30 meg using everything, yeah. Yes?
Can you give a breakdown of the parts costs?
A breakdown of the parts costs. Yes, there's actually a spreadsheet in the SVN where I put my estimates of part costs that came from the catalogues, I guess, like DigiKey. The SD RAM chip was around $50 when you buy them one off from DigiKey, but the Chinese guys get them for like $5 each, you know, in volume. The Blackfin processor is around $12-$13 US. Flash chip $3 or $4. The rest of it's the modules, $10 each to make. Hate to say it, these $90 modules did you sell you cost less than $10 each to make. They got good margins. But yes.
Would you recommend the digital thin button boards as a good way to play around with working with DSP?
Yeah, I would. The question was, would I recommend the Blackfin stamp, do you mean? Or the ASFID? There's a development board. If you just want to mess around with the Blackfin and UC Linux, you can buy that from DigiKey, I think. It's Analog Devices, sell it around $200, and that lets you mess around with DSP and UC Linux. And yes, I would recommend that as a reasonable way to mess around with DSP. It'll run Asterisk too, our distros run on it. Yeah.
Is the software environment available on
the website? Yes, it is. There's several. The question was, where is the software environment available? There's about three distros now that are out there for running Asterisk on the Blackfin with various hardware. I'm working on one at the moment that does packaging, because we've got all that NAND flash. We're looking at, say, using packages to install, like an OpenWRT or apt-get, running on the embedded hardware, to make updating, because it is a very hard, it is quite difficult to compile and add applications, so we're trying to simplify that.
Okay, one last question.
Yes.
When people see, you know,
question was, have people come up with other applications for it? Yeah. Some guys in America are doing a fax application. Support 100 to have a specialist fax box. Don't know what else. I'd like to do some software-defined radio on it. It'd be great for that. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, to eat that up. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.